Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Good to be back with you for another season. We were last with you for a special programme on Saturday, August 25th, for the arrival of Pope Francis in Ireland ahead of his 36-hour visit, when the eyes of the world were closely focused on our country and we came under an intense global media spotlight. One headline from the Washington Post was, "The last time a Pope visited Ireland, homosexuality was a crime. Now the Prime Minister is gay." The New York Times, "In Ireland, Pope Francis finds a country transformed and a church in tatters." In the Argentinian newspaper The Clarion, "The streets of Dublin, scenes of protest against the Pope's visit." The Telegraph, "Pope shares pain and shame at church's failings over Irish abuse during the historic visit." And finally, "Die Welt" in Germany, "The once most Catholic country, does not welcome the Pope." That was 4 weeks ago. So what has changed and what's yet to change? For our first programme, we've invited some of the Irish journalists who covered this historic event to share their insights. With me in the studio are Sarah MacDonald, freelance journalist who writes for The Tablet and Irish Independent, Patsy McGarry, religious affairs correspondent at The Irish Times, and Joe Little, RT's religious and social affairs correspondent. You're all very welcome to the programme. Sarah, can I begin with you? 4 weeks later, as you heard those international headlines, do the headline writers get it right?
I think in many respects it was very complex, the visit. I mean, one of the observations made by Christopher Lamb, who's actually the Tablet's Rome correspondent, and he said the magic of the papacy just didn't connect with the Irish people. He also noted that it was one of the most difficult papal visits of Francis's pontificate. I think it was a visit of two halves. Certainly on Saturday, you could say it was largely successful, whereas Sunday, reality bites. And that wasn't just because of what unfolded with the Vigano revelations, but I think the weather, and I think it was just a little bit more downbeat. Francis had engaged with the survivors at that stage, and that maybe put people back, their focus once again back on the issue that was, some people said, overshadowing the whole event. But I mean, it couldn't but, you know, be at the heart of it because of the experience of the Irish Church and also what had emerged from Pennsylvania, the grand jury report, and the Pope's own letter to the people.
Patsy McGarry, again, the headline writers, the sub-editors more likely, did they get it right?
I think generally, yeah, they did. As regards the visit itself, I thought the man connected with the people. I thought that he confirmed the affection people feel for him. I don't think it made any difference where the institution is concerned in Ireland. I think it will not lead to one single new vocation. It will not halt the decline of the church. There's no indication it will lead to an increase in mass attendance where the church is concerned. It was far too short. It lasted, they say, 36 hours. Actually, it was 32 hours. And there's too much attempted to be squeezed into that short space of time.
Well, the other thing that, of course, a lot of people were very interested in were some of the metrics. And we, you know, we heard, for example, that 1 million people watched the event on RTE television and however many people were at the Phoenix Park. They weren't all watching with Schadenfreude. They weren't all waiting for something awful to happen. So there were still a fair amount of people wanted to follow the event.
And they did so with great enthusiasm. I know people who watched it from, well, for want of a better phrase, dawn to dusk, and were very much taken by the coverage and by the man. And I mean, he apologised about the abuse issue, etc., over and over and over again, including the mass in the Phoenix Park. But people want more than apologies or expressions of shame and sorrow at this stage. We've enough of that. We've been listening to it for 20 years in Ireland. We want change. The people of Ireland want change. And above all, as a country or a Catholic country that suffered so much because of the mishandling of abuse, the systematic cover-up of abuse by bishops and religious leaders, we have the right to demand the church at central level, that is in Rome, begin seriously to address that matter there.
Joe, was it a difficult tone to capture?
I think that Patsy's newspaper, The Irish Times' opinion poll conducted within the 24 hours of the Pope departing Dublin Airport provided some interesting data. It showed that 55% of those polled felt that Pope Francis had not done enough, had not gone far enough to address the issue of child abuse in the church, while 31% felt he had gone far enough and 14% didn't know. I think the church might take some encouragement from that figure. It means that well over a third of Catholics felt that the Pope had done enough to address the issue. Now, I don't think that reflects a complacency. I think that there is, as Patsy has expressed there, within the Catholic Church, a deep sense of despair among people who would like to be in the pews but who have stopped going to church regularly. And I think, judging by the Irish Times figures, well over a third of Irish Catholics are impressed that he had done enough to address the issue. And of course, that perhaps emerged in his exchange with the survivors on the Saturday night. Paul Redmond and Clodagh Malone told RT News after emerging from that meeting, they were two of the seven people who met him, survivors and survivors' advocates, he had used a rather extraordinary phrase.
Well, let's go with that actual clip, and because it is important for us to set in context the voices that were being heard in the days and weeks prior to the visit.
We're hopeful that he will challenge what he referred to as the high church or the elite within the church who are guilty of corruption and cover-up. And he was stunned us all by referring to them as caca. And his translator was quite taken aback and clarified with him, but he literally said that they were filth in a toilet.
What we asked was a question for the 100,000 women and children to say that they didn't commit a sin, that they didn't do anything wrong, that it wasn't a mortal sin to go looking for your mother or for the mother to look for their child. So he's going to say that tomorrow, I think, at the end of his Mass.
That was Paul Redmond and Clodagh Malone there from the Coalition of Mother and Baby Home Survivors. And we heard the word there, Joe, caca, which was, I suppose, an attention grabber for a lot of people. They suddenly went, oh, right, this is not just simply somebody giving us a script answer.
No, and as I think Paul said, the translator at the nunciature on the Navan Road was stunned by the use of the word. And apparently he looked at the Pope and said, you really mean me to translate what you've just said? And poo apparently is a better translation than the more maybe vernacular explanation or uses or translations. See, this is the thing. Patsy was saying the man engaged with the Irish people. And I think that's
survivors.
True. And the survivors. And the fact that the representation of survivors was not as per normal in these situations. Only in Chile have advocates for survivors who themselves have been abused have actually gone and met the Pope. Only Chileans, I should say. In Chile, he made the mistake of dismissing them. Then when he realised his mistake and discovered that evidence was being burned and shredded in Chile by the most senior of prelates in order to protect them from the implications of cover-up, he then began meeting survivors, representatives and survivors. And he did that here, and not just institutional survivors, not just survivors of... but the survivors in the most recent scandal, which is the mother and baby home scandal.
Sarah, would it be fair to say that commentators like yourselves were setting the scene for us that maybe not a lot was going to actually happen over the course of the visit?
Well, I think there's an understanding that, Pope Francis is, even though some people would argue that he's his own man, he really is, I suppose, subject to the Vatican bureaucracy. And this was something that Mary Collins highlighted during the World Meeting of Families, that she had explained it before, that the reason she resigned from the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors was that the proposals they'd put forward were stymied by the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, and that even though Pope Francis had agreed with them in 2015, they were kind of knocked back. And that's frustrating. So I think there's an understanding that even though the Pope might use language which surprises Vatican officials and surprises the general public, at the end of the day, he's not able to shift things as quickly as he might want to. And I suppose people would judge the Irish visit on the basis of what is actually achieved, tangible results. It's not just, as Patsy said, it's not just about apologies and words at this stage.
But there were other issues as well. I mean, the dominant issue in the latter days leading up to the visit was, of course, the abuse issue. But prior to that, and indeed in the 6 months leading up to the visit itself, even before it was confirmed, when it was announced about the content of the pastoral council, the controversy that began last January when they removed same-sex images or images of same-sex couples, which led to huge controversy, eventually involving former President Mary McAleese, eventually leading to her being banned from taking part in a discussion in the Vatican, which created a huge furore and led to her extraordinary address last March about this empire of misogyny in the church itself. And she spoke about this in the lead-up. And I think that that also, the LGBT issue and the status of women in the church also affected the turnout for the papal visit here in Ireland, I do believe.
Could the Vatican have had any idea the amount of preparedness there would be from the various different groups of people prior to this visit?
I don't think the Vatican knew about it. I don't think people here in Ireland anticipated it either, or anticipated, for instance, the protest that took place to coincide with the mass in the Phoenix Park on Parnell Square that Sunday, that there would be such a huge turnout of people.
Mm. Now, you have a clip that you've selected, which was Colm O'Gorman on Morning Ireland.
What I've been doing since 1998, when I launched my own legal action to try to force the Vatican to reveal what they knew about the rape and abuse of children, is I've just asked popes to tell the damn truth. And if Francis is going to come here in any way address the child abuse issue, he needs to take responsibility and own the established, proven fact of the cover-up of the rape and abuse of children at a global level, led by and facilitated by the Vatican. Anything less than that is just a nonsense.
If there were to be a meeting, Dermot Martin said that you would have to get a small group of people together, and he did sort of point up the fact that that could be difficult, getting that group together. Is there coordination between you and, say, the other groups as to who might meet the Pope if he were to agree to this?
Look, I mean, first of all, I think people need to be clear about what the purpose of a meeting is. If the purpose of a meeting is to present the Vatican with an opportunity to show that they've ticked that box and the Pope can express his sorrow about the hurt, I think that's just exploiting and further abusing people.
So you sound like you don't actually want a meeting. It wouldn't be
the
welcome.
The Pope doesn't need, and it's not necessary for victims to go in and to lay out again their trauma and their hurt in front of him so they can use it as a PR exercise. What the Pope needs to do is simply tell the truth, and he can choose how he wants to do it. Now, if he wants to have meetings with survivors on the side of all of that, if he feels that's important and significant, and it will be for some people, that's fine. But actually, he just needs to do the thing that we've been trying to get the Vatican to do for decades now: tell the truth.
They do have great difficulty in acknowledging cover-up, and I think that is the issue. And Sarah talked about his backing the proposal from the Commission for the Protection of Minors in 2015, that a tribunal be set up to hold bishops to account with the authority to dismiss a bishop who had covered up the abuse of children. The Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, in classic Sir Humphrey style, says we don't need this, it's already there, and they talked him down. So the following year he brought in what's called a motu proprio, basically more or less saying he would deal with these cases individually. And his press conference on the way back to Rome on the plane, he talked about handling this case, one case in Guam himself, removing the Archbishop of Guam last May. He can't deal with every case himself personally.
No, and Archbishop Martin, if I may interject, Michael. Archbishop Martin made this clear in his homily on the Sunday before the Pope arrived here in the Pro-Cathedral, where he talked about the need to beef up the Commission for the Protection of Minors, that is the body to which Mary Collins and one other survivor belonged in its initial iteration, and there are more survivors on it now, but Mary Collins, as we know, resigned from it, over this precise issue of making bishops and other religious superiors accountable for their covering up of abuse. So Archbishop Martin has put out the prescription in the immediate for institutional reform on this. Let's see when that's implemented. And if it's not, the Irish Church and the Irish Church leadership will feel very repulsed by the results of
what
this.
What Archbishop Martin also said in that address before the Pope arrived is that the Commission needed to be stronger, and it doesn't have strong leadership. And indeed, it was significant, I think, that its leader, Cardinal Sean O'Malley, couldn't attend the Pastoral Congress because of problems in his own seminary. Mm. Those are two things that happened, which was in anticipation of the visit. He had to withdraw from the Pastoral Congress, and Cardinal Wuerl, the Archbishop of Washington, had also to withdraw, and for the same reason, because of mishandling of clerical child sex abuse.
Sarah MacDonald, I want to bring you in on that too.
What I find kind of interesting is an interview that Cardinal Vincent Nichols did with Marian Finucane, because he argued that since 2001, no credible allegation against a priest has not been reported to public authorities. Just referring to Vincent Nichols, he also said, just in discussing, you know, the role of women in the church, that we can't suggest that it's a matter of bringing women into governance and that the problem will be solved. He highlighted the fact that religious orders run by women were guilty of, you know, overseeing abuse as well. It was his interaction with Marian Finucane as a woman who was asking hard questions around governance.
It got a bit touchy.
It did.
Yeah.
And it was around governance and policy making for women. And she brought it back to abuse. And then he said something which reminded me of the Pope's response to Mary Collins. He said that you're a little bit preoccupied with the abuse issue.
Okay, well, and we can actually hear that clip from the programme, which was broadcast on the Saturday morning. It's Cardinal Vincent Nichols talking to Marian Finucane.
If you take the policies that were made by groups of bishops and groups of cardinals on procedure for, as you said, thousands of years, on advice, on policy, on those kind of things, why are women so excluded?
Now, governance. Okay, there are certain fora in which crucial decisions are made by the nominated leadership of the church, which for religious orders of women is all women, which for the overall church, as you say, are men who are ordained bishops and therefore are responsible to and for the whole community.
But since they've made a hash of it, if you accept what you say, that they have made a complete hash of dealing, well, you implied it. You said shame and sorrow and shame and sorrow.
Are you back to the abuse issues?
Well, I'm thinking of policy.
You're a bit preoccupied with it, if you don't mind saying so.
Well, I am, yes, because I think it is tragic that lives have been destroyed and that there have been cover-ups. I mean, it's very hard not to be moved by that.
If I may, those things have happened also in religious orders governed by women and led by women. They have faced the same problems. So please don't let's pretend that somehow women have all the answers and men have all the problems.
I never said that.
No, but just but let's keep it shape.
If you look with my eyes at major events happening in the church, I keep on saying to anybody that will listen to me, look at all those women there as parades of males, looking resplendent and gorgeous, and it's beautifully done. Not a sign of a woman.
That was Cardinal Vincent Nicholls talking with Marion Finucane. Sarah, the frustration in Marion's voice towards the end, is that what it's going to be like for the average Irish Catholic who still sees a role for themselves in the church? Oh, sure, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to change.
I think there's mutual incomprehension there. Mm. You know, this is a high ranking. He's president of the British Conference of Bishops. He's the Archbishop of Westminster. And he just can't understand why Marion can't see that nuns running education, you know, that's good enough. Whereas Marion has seen it from the perspective of Mary McAleese, and I would say the majority of our Irish women. I mean, Patsy's Irish Times poll again showed the huge support there is for ordination of women.
Patsy, Mary McAleese was very much a thorn in the side of the Catholic Church in the period up to the World Meeting of Families, and she made her feelings known on many occasions.
Yes, and ended up being banned from taking part in a discussion in the Vatican by the man who was behind the whole World Meeting of Families, Cardinal Kevin Farrell of the Dicastery for Faith, Family and Laity.
And we can actually hear an interview that Mary McAleese had with Brendan O'Connor, who was filling in for Marion Finucane.
When the LGBT family images were removed from the World Meeting of Family material, you were devastated.
Yes. Because I had hoped that this World Meeting of Families would be different from every other World Meeting of Families. I think many people who will come to the World Meeting are unaware of how we came to have in the Catholic Church in recent years this thing called the World Meeting of Families. It was originated by a Colombian cardinal called López Trujillo, a notoriously anti-gay, ultra-Orthodox man who believed that divorce, abortion and all of these things, he lumped them all together as evidence of a secular war that he personally had to, and the church had to resist.
So the very idea of the World Meeting of Families is quite what people might refer to as a kind of a right-wing fundamentalist.
Yes, it's always been
Catholic
essentially a right-wing rally within the church's teaching. That's what it's always been.
A right-wing rally.
Yeah, it's a right-wing rally. And it was designed for that purpose, to rally people, to get them motivated to fight against the tide of same-sex marriage, rights for gays, abortion rights, contraceptive rights.
You said recently that one of the most devastating moments of your presidency was the request from Cardinal Sodano that the Irish government would not look for documents from the Vatican. Something that we know is still going on. I mean, we saw it again with Ian Elliott during the week talking about he doesn't believe he got all the documents in various cases. Why the most devastating?
Because it was in that moment that I realised that the problems that we were experiencing in Ireland were not problems that had been generated just by our bishops on their own accidentally being negligent. I realised that in that moment things were orchestrated directly from Rome.
And I suppose some people are surprised you didn't bring it up. You've been talking about this even for a while since your presidency. You've been studying canon law and everything. People are surprised you didn't bring it up before now.
Well, nobody asked me the question. A very simple thing. Nobody asked me the question. It came out in response to a very simple question from Patsy McGarry. At an event 2 weeks ago where I was launching Donald Doerr's book on the Pope Francis agenda. And he raised the question with me about the fact that the bishops and the cardinals did not cooperate and didn't offer documentation freely, and why that might be the case. And he asked me did I think that culture had changed. And I said that I hoped that it had changed from my experience back with Cardinal Sodano. I literally just threw it in like that. I mean, I didn't take a deliberate decision that today is the day I reveal.
It's time to drop
it
the bomb.
It was. Okay. The first time I was asked the question, I answered it honestly. And I also answered it by saying that I hoped that times had changed and that this documentation would be willingly offered up. And in fact, I'm really rather saddened that so much of the stories that we know about abuse and about bishops' negligence, we never heard directly from our church.
No, in fact, some people would argue that the church fought it every inch
of
the way.
Well, I have to say,
they?
When I had that conversation, very, very brief as it was, with Cardinal Sodano, I formed a view then that day that we would never hear it from our church.
Patsy, when you heard Mary McAleese answer that question, what was your own reaction?
I was taken aback, to say the least. As she recalled it there, she's absolutely accurate. I was at the launch and I'm fixated on this issue about the documents that the Vatican has. Mm. And I asked her, what was her view of this matter? That they have these documents since 2001 and have refused to hand them over to any statutory inquiry, certainly in Ireland. And then she comes out with this thing about Sodano.
We've painted a picture in the programme so far of the difficulties and what has gotten us to the point where we are now. What I want to look at next is Pope Francis the right person for the job, for the fix, for what is to happen next?
The statement that most impressed me during the visit that he made when the cameras were rolling, as it were, was at the Capuchin Centre in Dublin, where he told Brother Kevin Crowley and the assembled Capuchin community, the volunteers, the homeless people, individuals and families, he said of the Capuchin's work, he said, if you become separated from the people, you will fall away as church. And that sums up exactly the terrible contradiction in what's happened in the church in Ireland. Here's a church where idealists, women and men, founded religious congregations like the Presentation Sisters of Charity, Christian Brothers, Presentation Brothers, and devoted themselves to urchins on the streets, you know, in appalling conditions in the early 19th century largely, and onwards through the famine and so on, and was the only outlet for idealistic civil society movements apart from the state church, okay? And it did this work. And yet, after regenerating itself in that way, it has found itself in a position where power corrupted. I think you can say the only possibility for renewal in the Catholic Church is through radical social action and engagement.
He did signal that very clearly to people that were there, because he was asked if Jesus returned today and was knocking at the door. He said he'd be knocking to get out of the church, not to get into it. So he was very clearly signalling the level of frustration that he has.
To go back to your question, Michael. Yeah. Yes, he is the man. He's a natural appeal. He's very sincere and very genuine, but he needs help. Mm. He needs the help of strong people around him who are as convinced about the evils of clericalism as convinced as he is, and who can address the matter through serious reform.
Sarah?
I definitely feel he's the man. I mean, a poll taken in Ireland last year, Irish people voted him as the most popular world leader for them. Mm. I think globally he is loved, and I think he was definitely a breath of fresh air coming after two very conservative papacies. But Patsy is right, he needs help. And I think we know that after seeing what happened on the Sunday of the papal visit with the bombshell from Archbishop Vigano. That is motivated by a desire to bring down this papacy. Hmm.
Is there a civil war going on in the Roman Catholic Church?
Unequivocally, absolutely. Yes. And it's ideologically driven. It's not driven by Christianity. It has nothing to do with either Catholicism or Christianity. It's to do with a very narrow view, centred, it seems, on homosexuality, basically as a weapon rather than the issue itself, it would appear, to bring down this papacy because they perceive it as being too fudged at the edges. It's not; it doesn't have the straight lines that they had under Benedict and under John Paul, not least to do with communion for divorced and remarried Catholics. They don't like this "who am I to judge" type of philosophy.
Do we know where that centre is for
it's traditionists. It's traditionists like Cardinal Burke. It's mainly American rooted. What's happening is an attempt to cripple Francis, and I don't think we are stressing enough how dangerous the situation is for him. I mean, what has been alleged has been that he covered up sexual abuse by Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. Mm. Ultimately, the Vatican and Pope Francis have to answer to this because it's very serious, and a lot of people don't understand the politics that are behind that. But what is important is to realise that the Vatican first became aware of these allegations against McCarrick back in 2000-2001, and that Pope Saint John Paul II elevated him to a cardinal and also made him Archbishop of Washington. So, you know, if we're going to start asking questions, we need to go back to the pontificate of the conservative greats, as in John Paul II. And Benedict XVI, you know, who supposedly imposed strictures upon him, but allowed him to flout those strictures.
And the extraordinary statement by Archbishop Vigano himself in 2012 when introducing Cardinal McCarrick to an event, although he knew, it seems, at that point that there was a restriction on Cardinal McCarrick because of his sexual proclivities, as our dear friend. So he's in Washington, D.C. as the nuncio at that time, and he is part of what Sarah is saying is that there was a conservative groupthink about promoting people like Cardinal McCarrick. Mm-hmm. Archbishop Vigano was not, it seems, immune from that groupthink, yet he feels qualified now to interject, I would say, on perhaps, as somebody has said, the most difficult papal visit of this pontificate, on the most difficult single subject faced by the last three pontificates, and to basically show the red card from the conservative camp to former Cardinal Bergoglio, now Pope Francis.
Mm-hmm. Patsy McGarry.
The Vigano letter, issued when the Pope was in Ireland, about to say the Mass in the Phoenix Park, had one intention, and that was to do maximum damage. It was an exocet aimed at the Pope. But he does have to answer a question about the 2013 meeting between himself and Vigano, where Vigano claims they discussed McCarrick and McCarrick's activities. He cannot ignore that. And apparently the Vatican decided last week that they will be responding to Vigano.
And that's where we have to leave it. Thank you for joining us on this edition of The Leap of Faith. My thanks to Sarah MacDonald, freelance writer with The Tablet and The Irish Independent, Patsy McGarry, religious affairs correspondent with The Irish Times, and Joe Little, RT's religious and social affairs correspondent. If you'd like to contact the programme, you can email faith@rte.ie. From all of us here tonight, good night.